Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Hi, I'm Robert Krulwich.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
This is Radiolab.
And in this hour, a show about brains.
Yes.
When we think about our brains, if we ever think about our brains.
Which we don't very often.
No.
You can blink, your heart can beat, you don't think these things.
Yeah, you don't even think about it even when you're thinking.
Right. So you and your brain have a kind of quiet agreement to just get along.
Yeah, but every so often you and your brain fall out of agreement.
Yeah.
And then where are you?
We have four stories about just that.
Yeah.
Starting with this one.
A short time ago, we got an email from a listener in San Francisco.
Something odd had happened to her, and she wanted to share it with us.
I didn't hit the record button fast enough.
Okay.
Could you just tell me your name again?
Sure.
My
name is Liza Schoenfeld, and I'm a research technician at the Gladstone Institute at the University of California, San Francisco.
Now, Liza is just getting started with her scientific career.
Finished my undergraduate degree about a year and a half ago.
And this story takes place as she was about to take that next step after college and apply to grad school.
And the star of our story, other than, of course, Liza herself,
yep,
is a little mischievous part of her brain. Well, everyone's brain.
Part of your brain called the basal ganglia.
Basal ganglia, which at the time she'd been studying.
The basal ganglia is a fairly large part of your brain.
It's actually this big hunk deep in the center.
And it's responsible for controlling and coordinating movement.
Well, when I move my neck back and forth, am I using my basal ganglia?
Yeah.
When I make an expression in my face, am I using my basal ganglia?
Definitely.
What about if I'm reading The New Yorker?
I don't think so.
Apologies to The New Yorker and its employees.
The point is, this part of your brain is really basic.
And at the lab where she was working, they had figured out this particular basal ganglia trick.
Using this really cool technology called optogenetics.
What they'd done is they'd found a way to take a mouse, thread a little fiber optic cable through its skull, deep into its brain, into its basal ganglia.
So that when you shine a blue laser, literally we just shine lasers into mouse brains.
They could actually turn its basal ganglia, or parts of it, on or off.
And this is in a live mouse?
This is in a live mouse. So we
Wow.
have these really cool videos showing a mouse running around, having a great mouse time. You turn the light on,
boom,
we can get him to freeze.
In mid-stride?
Yeah.
So
freeze.
You hit the laser and boom, the mouse stops?
The mouse is like this.
So you use
frozen
light to, like,
yes,
puppetize the mouse?
Yes.
If you're this mouse, no matter how hard you try,
move, feet.
Move! As long as that light is on,
come on, move!
You can't do it. Liza is holding the strings.
Not exactly. It turns out she doesn't get to play with the laser that much.
I'm kind of like, I'm the bottom of the totem pole, so I do a lot of pipetting.
It's like where you squirt liquid from one tube to another.
I'm working on my pipetting skills these days.
Grunt work.
Okay, get the thumb muscles
yeah
up.
Oh, I could beat anyone in the thumb wrestling competition right now.
So, at a certain point, she was like, enough of this. It's time for me to apply to grad school.
Yeah, I applied to 5. University of California, San Diego, University of Washington in Seattle, UCSF, Rockefeller University, and Harvard.
Okay, so you're going big.
Yeah, go big or go home.
Right, exactly.
So she heads off to her first interview.
University of Washington, went great, I loved it.
Okay.
Went down to UCSD in San Diego. It's a beautiful place, great scientists. It's actually the largest neuroscience community in the world.
So far, so good.
Did you ever go back to San Francisco, where we are now?
This is where things get strange.
Yes, so my last interview, my very last interview was at UCSF.
And she says about a week before that interview,
I got really sick, pretty severe nausea. I wasn't really able to eat or do anything. And
throwing up?
Yeah, oh, all sorts of, I don't know. I had some bad dim sum the weekend before. That could have been it.
Yeah, that's it. So she goes to the doctor. He gives her some pills to fight the nausea.
And then the next day was my interview. Friday was my interview. So I went, you know, there's a nice introduction. They give you breakfast.
At this point, she's pretty familiar with the whole routine.
Generally, the way these interviews are structured is that we talk a little bit about my research in dopamine and the basal ganglia and these mice.
They tell her about their work.
I have to think of a couple witty questions. I ask my questions.
Anyhow, she's raring to go, and she heads in to meet her first basal gangliatician of the day.
And he studies, one of the things he studies is dopamine.
In the basal ganglia.
He studies stuff that's a little bit more molecular than what I know, but we had a good conversation about dopamine, and at this point in the day, I was feeling okay.
No nausea.
Then I went to my second interview, which is this woman that I was so excited to talk to. Her name is Allison Dope, and she's pretty well known.
Her name is Allison Dope?
Wow. Allison Dope.
Wow, and she studies dopamine?
She studies songbirds.
Songbirds.
Which is what Liza really wanted to study.
So birds have basal ganglia, too.
So she's pretty fired up.
And kind of at the beginning of that interview, my face started to feel a little bit strange, and I was wearing glasses that day. So what I thought was happening was that my glasses were, you know, your glasses get loose and they kind of start to slip down your nose, and you have to kind of tighten the muscles around your ears to try and keep your glasses on. So we were talking, and I just kept on feeling like, God, why can't I stop tightening that? It was kind of got to the point where it started to distract me, but I felt okay. Then we went to lunch, and this was a lunch with all the current students and a lot of the current faculty and all the prospective students. And at lunch, I remember on the walk to lunch, my head just started spontaneously turning to the right.
Like I
would be trying to sit here and face you, and I would just turn over here and face Robert.
That's such a funny thing. It's was your neck moving and you're like, no neck, don't do that neck.
Yes, exactly what was happening. I was trying to send signals to my neck being like, all right, sitting here having lunch with an important professor, why don't you just face him, talk to him? And instead I'm just turning over here, turning over here.
Oh, you're turning a fairly wide arc.
Yeah.
You are turning away from the professor.
Yeah. So I remember at one point in lunch turning my chair like this. So I could
you're
sit
trying
here
to rotate.
And talk to him.
a permanent sidelong glance.
Yeah.
But you figured, it must just be a cramp or something.
And I'm kind of thinking, oh, okay, so I slept funny last night. I must have slept on a weird angle on my pillow. Now I'm having a neck cramp. My glasses are loose. I just got to tighten the glasses.
Yeah, everything under control.
So then I, after lunch, was going to go to my third interview. It was with Allison Dope's husband, who also studies songbirds. So he's familiar with the basal ganglia, too.
They meet up to walk over to his office together.
And so I explained to him on the walkover, I think I'm having neck cramps. Would it be possible maybe to try and get a hot pad?
He says, sure, I may track one down.
But on the walk, not only now does my neck start turning to the right, but it's snapping itself back.
Involuntarily.
Yeah, my head's snapping back. Like
so you're, suddenly your eyes are pointed up at the sky.
And then as I'm talking to him, I'm realizing that I can't control my eyebrows from raising pretty tightly. So I look
like you're doing right now?
Like I'm doing
so
right now.
So you're in a state of deep surprise.
Yes,
to read your
constant
face.
Deep surprise.
High eyebrow.
I can't stop it. I look surprised at everything I'm saying, and I can't stop it. So after the eyebrows start, and I can't pull them back down, then the mouth, then all this area starts to go.
The lower face.
Yes.
What is it doing?
It turns into this really twisted, painful, grimacing smile.
Would you mind demonstrating?
I'll demo it. Okay, so I've got the neck is like this.
Crane back.
The eyebrows are like this.
Total surprise.
My face is a little like this.
Crazy Frankenstein face.
This is not obviously the best demeanor for a graduate interview.
No, yeah, it's not going well at that point.
Is Michael now noticing that something is...
Yeah, I think at that point he thought I was just really excited to be talking about neuroscience. And I'm just trying to think, okay, mouth, like, try and just calm down a little bit. And it was pretty painful, too. I mean, it was like, imagine like a Charlie horse in your face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But she gets through the interview.
I actually do okay. You know, he asked me tough questions about science, and I can answer them, I think. And I leave the interview, and then I'm met by the woman who's the head of the admissions weekend.
And she took one look at Liza.
And she said, I don't know if you should do the rest of your interviews. And with her is my student host.
And Liza decides, all right, let me just call my dad.
Just to say, hey, Dad, I'm in the middle of my interview, and something kind of funny is happening with my face. I can't control it. And while I'm talking to him, I lose control of my mouth and my tongue. So I can't. I can kind of talk, but it's pretty bad.
Pretty bad.
Is your dad a doctor?
No. Imagine your kid calling you being like, I'm losing control of my face. And as they're telling you that, I started to think something's really wrong. And then my student host comes rushing back in, running. And he looks at me and he tries to put on a calm face and he says, "So now we need to go to the emergency room."
So they throw her into a taxi.
And in the taxi, it went from "I can't control my mouth" to a complete...
Palsied and a torque.
I did not look good. As we're pulling up to the emergency room is when my throat started tightening up.
They rush her inside.
And they have me in a gurney, in a room in the back of the ER, surrounded by six people within 2 minutes.
Doctors swarming all around her.
An oxygen mask, EKG leads all over my chest. They do an IV.
And as she's lying there on the table, she's thinking, like, what's wrong with me? Why can't I control my throat? Why can't I control my body?
And I remember frantically sending messages like, you gotta cut this out now.
But she wasn't in control. And it turned out that while she was going from interview to interview to interview, talking about how her lab had taken these little mices and seized control of their basal ganglia,
the Compazine that I took,
that nausea drug,
was actually affecting the dopamine systems in my basal ganglia.
In other words, that drug had been doing to her
pretty much what she'd been
doing to those mice.
1-2% of people who take Compazine, they can have what's called an acute dystonia, which is what happened to me.
During all those interviews.
And the crazy thing is, the guy that I talked to first in the morning was the molecular dopamine guy. You know, how does dopamine get packed in the vesicles? How does it get released? And it wasn't until I started talking with the more systems level people who studied the behavioral output of the basal ganglia that I started to have behavioral deficits in my basal ganglia.
Wow.
So your basal ganglia are testing the San Francisco docs and they are failing in issue.
Yeah.
Did you get into San Francisco State?
UCSF.
UCSF?
No.
No.
Oh.
Damn it, basal ganglia.
We should probably tell everybody that Liza's obviously doing okay. Back in the ER, when the doctors finally figured out what was going on, they just gave her some Benadryl, of all things.
And actually, within 20 minutes, I was feeling a lot better.
She could breathe. Her face had unclenched. And when we asked her, how has this little adventure changed you? She said, well, I'm still working with those mice. Because when we talked to her, grad school hadn't started yet. And now, when I go into that room with a little laser,
I go in now and I just really, I empathize with them.
Come on, little Casper, this will just be for a couple of minutes.
You can do it.
Yeah, I'm thinking a lot about that.
Liza Schoenfeld is now a proud PhD candidate at the University of Washington.
And thanks to Brenna Farrell for production help on that story.
Okay, so Liza's disagreement with her brain didn't last very long. It was over within really less than a day.
Yeah.
But there are people who get into fusses with their heads that last longer.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a bigger, better, and broader story.
Also a true story. Comes from an essay written many years ago by a guy named Bertrand Russet, who's this great, I don't know, how would you describe him?
Bertrand Russet, he was a great essayist. Journalism essayist.
Yeah, and this essay was published in 1958 in The New Yorker. And it's kind of an interesting essay because it's essentially one long quote from this woman that Burton interviewed, Rosemary Morton. It reads like a novel, even though it's nonfiction. So we asked an actress who's been in some movies, Hope Davis, to read excerpts from Rosemary's story. The story begins on a normal night. Rosemary's at home with her husband, Frank. And everything's fine, for the moment.
I'd been home about an hour. Dinner was ready and waiting in the oven, and I was sitting at the piano, not really playing, just amusing myself. That's something I often do at the end of the day. It helps me relax. My husband was in the kitchen making us a cocktail, which is another Morton custom. We usually have a drink or two before dinner. So everything was quite ordinary and normal. Until Frank came in with the drinks. I got up to join him on the sofa, and as I did, as I started across the room, I felt the floor sort of shake. Good heavens, I said, what was that? Frank just looked at me. His face was a perfect blank. He made some remark about old buildings stretching and settling and handed me my drink.
So she doesn't really think too much of this, because it was very momentary.
Okay.
But a week later, she's at work. She's actually in the library, because she's a librarian. She's at her desk.
I worked at my desk for about an hour, and it was heaven, so quiet, so peaceful. Then I got up to get a book from the stacks or a drink of water or something, and it happened. The floor gave a shake and sank. It went down and up, just one lurch, maybe a little more pronounced than the first time. And then everything was back to normal. Except for my state of mind. I didn't know what to think. The best I could do was tell myself that this was an old building, too. It was built around 1900.
So that was her sense at first. Just old buildings.
It never occurred to me that there might be any other explanation.
But then, over the next few days, very odd things begin to happen.
I don't know how to describe it, but I had the feeling that my sense of touch was getting more and more acute. Especially in the soles of my feet. I could feel little tremors that other people couldn't. I didn't tell Frank until the middle of the following week, on Wednesday night, to be exact. By then, I had to. I couldn't keep it to myself any longer. There was something wrong with me. There just wasn't any word for the awful sensations I'd been having. The floor shaking feeling was only one of them. I don't know how many times that happened over the weekend, 7 or 8 at least. But even that began to have a different feeling. At first, the floor had moved or sagged as a whole. It still did. Only now I could feel another movement, too, a kind of counterpoint. Sometimes it was as if I were sinking into the floor. The room would tilt, and I'd take a step, and the floor was like snow. It would give under my foot, and I would sink. And other times it was just the reverse. The floor would rise up to meet me. By then, it wasn't simply the floor that moved. When the floor tilted, the walls of the room tilted with it, and the ceiling. I mean, the shape of the room never changed, only its position in space.
So Rosemary went to see her doctor. And her doctor sent her to some specialists, and they ran some tests. And then a short while later, she went back to her doctor to get the results.
He'd read me their conclusions, and they were all the same. They even used the same phrase. Impression, essentially normal. I'll never forget that phrase. Normal, essentially normal. It sounds so reassuring, so comforting. But it isn't. At least it wasn't to me. It was terrifying.
After this diagnosis, or non-diagnosis, things really take a turn. Fast forward a few months.
There were times in March and early April when I was absolutely certain I was going to die. But my reaction to death was peculiar. I don't remember feeling afraid. All I remember is an overwhelming sense of urgency. So little time, so little done, so much I wanted to do. I dragged Frank to the theater more than once, and I never thought of refusing when he suggested the Philharmonic or the Metropolitan. My response to music had never been so complete. I spent hours listening to records. I'd play some old favorite like Beecham conducting Haydn's London Symphony, and it was amazing. It seemed to me that I could hear the inner structure more clearly than ever before. So the idea of a dinner and a concert wasn't at all unusual. My only mistake was to take that dreadful underground passage. It was raining and I was in a hurry, but even so, I should have realized. When I did, it was too late. The passage was jammed with commuters, shoving and pushing and surging toward me. but I didn't dare turn back. The floor was beginning to wobble, and I knew if I tried to swing around, it would tip me head over heels. All I could do was go on. The traffic was still all against me. People kept looming up, towering up. They came charging at me like giants. And then I felt something right out of a nightmare. I was almost at the end of the passage when I felt the movement change. It was as if someone had pulled a lever. There was a little jolt, and the floor was moving very slowly backward down the passage. I was walking on a treadmill. Only for a minute, though. Then I reached the stairs. I drove myself up to the lobby and collapsed in a chair. I was jelly. From early April, I began to move in a different world. I was conscious of a new dimension, a new plane. I had a new relationship to space. My legs, my arms, my face, my whole body felt different. It had no permanent shape. It changed by the minute. I seemed to be completely at the mercy of some outside force, some atmospheric pressure. I was amorphous. My left leg would seem to lengthen, or my right arm, or my neck. Or one whole side of me would double or treble in size. And yet that doesn't fully describe it. There were times when the force seemed to be the rotation of the Earth. I would have the feeling that I was vertically aligned with the Earth's axis. I could feel a sort of winding movement start up inside me. Then one of my legs would begin to shorten, as if it were an anchor being drawn slowly up by a winch. The other leg would dangle. After a minute, the winch would shift. It would engage the dangling leg, and just as slowly, bring it up to match the other.
This feels like some kind of a nightmare cartoon of some kind.
Yeah.
So what is it? What is wrong with her?
Well, after months of this, at the end of the essay, she does finally learn that this condition she has a name.
My trouble was a disturbance of the internal ear called labyrinthitis.
Labyrinthitis.
The suffix itis meant inflammation.
Swelling.
So the meaning of labyrinthitis as a word was simply an inflammation of the oral labyrinth.
But you know, I think people in science and medicine love to give big fat names to I don't know.
Well, actually, this condition, you should know, goes by another name.
What?
Vertigo.
Oh.
That's why I like the story, because, like, I didn't know. I mean, like, I always thought of vertigo, like, from the movie.
Yeah.
Like, you're on a stairs, and you're like, woo,
yeah.
Woo. Like, it's just a thing with heights. You know, like, that's what it was in the Hitchcock film. But what Rosemary Morton goes through in this story, it's, like, seems way deeper. And at some point in the essay, she actually refers to her situation as a case of gravitational anarchy.
That's an interesting phrase.
I kind of like.
Yeah. Well, does she get better?
Yep.
It's impossible to say exactly when it all ended. But I think it was Frank who really sensed it first. It was after dinner one night in late August, and he suddenly smiled and remarked that I must be feeling much better. I asked him what he meant. "You never look scared anymore," he said.
It's very mysterious, but her vertigo just went away. Poof.
Without explanation for the coming and no explanation for the going?
Some things just don't have explanations, Robert. But they have wonderful sound design. And that's Radiolab. No explanations, pretty sounds.
I'd buy a ticket to that, Mr. Jeekers. I'm crazy for sound design.
I'm Jan Avumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
We'll be back.
Radio Lab. This is Liza Schoenfeld calling in with the credits. Radio Lab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and the Alfred T. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org. Radio Lab is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR.
End of message.
Radio Lab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, Lulu here. You asked and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program. That is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you either way for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Robert Krulwich.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
This is Radiolab.
Today, when brains attack.
Now, in this story, the next one up, we're going to meet somebody whose brain is, well, it's kind of keeping a secret from him. The brain knows something, but the brain isn't telling.
Well, really, first, it's a story of a friendship between two guys. Right. And the guy who told us the story is...
Andy Mills, and I am a freelance radio producer.
And the other guy, you'll meet him in a minute.
So maybe we should start, like, how did you meet? Like, what was the, where did you lay eyes on each other?
Well, it was my sophomore year of college, and it was the time that the freshmen are all moving into the dorms. And I was meeting new people, welcoming the freshmen.
Oh, you're an RA or you're some sort of...
No. Just one of those chatty people in the dorm.
You're like, what's your name?
Exactly. And as I was talking actually to a group of freshmen in my room, I hear this like strange noise from the room next door. It was this kind of low drone. So I kind of peeked over and saw, you know, a 18 to 19 year old kid in a wheelchair, dark curly hair, and this noise I'd been hearing was his voice. Not even a week later, I run into him in the hallway and I introduce myself. I say, "Hi, I'm Andy. What's your name?" And he said,
"My name is Con Ashmore. K-O-H-N.
Con
Ashmore.
Con Ashmore.
Yeah. I was on the way to eat lunch, and I invited him to join me. We sit down in the corner, and I notice, like, he brings the fork to his mouth, like, really slowly. everything about him is slowed down. Yeah. But also notice, like, he's witty, observant. And so at a certain point in the conversation, I asked him, what's wrong? Like, why do you move and talk so slowly?
You just asked him flat out?
Yeah.
Was he offended?
No.
No. I think he was relieved to find somebody who was willing to admit that it's a little bit weird.
Yeah.
Well.
And then he tells me the story.
The day was.
He started at the beginning.
November 15th.
He said, I was 8 years old.
I was out in the backyard.
I had this dog. The dog had run off.
Broke loose of his chain.
I ran out into the street. And the next thing I knew, I was waking up from a coma.
Yeah. Huh. 5 months.
5 months later.
He got hit by a car.
Yeah.
And when you woke up, what had happened to you? What were the injuries you suffered?
Well, I couldn't talk, couldn't move.
And then he comes out of it slowly and slowly. But thing is, he stays
slower.
Slow.
Very slow.
So this is a man who has slowed down globally.
Right. Except for, of course, his mind.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He does well in school. He's smart. He has a great sense of humor. And we connected, you know. I was his neighbor in the dorm, and we had a lot in common. We liked a lot of the same music. We used to stay up late. I'd play my acoustic guitar, and he would sing Matchbox 20 songs from the 90s. You know, he would...
You must slow down your playing? Is that what
my
happens?
Playing is not exactly rock star material or anything.
Yeah, I love that song. I think I know it by...
Wasn't long before we ended up having these really deep conversations into the middle of the night.
About what?
Well, the fact that both of our parents are divorced and how we both grew up in households that were fighting all the time and having to sleep at grandma's is like a regular part of both of our lives. We talked a lot about how like that impacted our life growing up and we just became really close.
The level situation. Tell me what you had for breakfast today.
You know, I've known Khan for almost a decade. But it wasn't until last summer that I decided to interview Khan on tape, and it was in the middle of this interview that Khan tells me this story that completely changed the way that I think about Khan and his slowness.
So, I really...
The story starts off with him in junior high. First big crush.
Julie.
Her name was Julie.
Back.
And he's trying to think of something romantic to do to catch her attention. And he really loves music. He was listening to his Walkman one night and he realized that that's what he wants to do. He would make her
a mixtape.
A romantic mixtape. And that would be the thing. Huh. So he makes this tape and then he decided that
I should try singing.
To actually sing a love song to Julie. So he writes the song, records it, puts the tape back in the stereo.
And when I played it back, woman is praying then I might. I remember being horrified. Yes, only, even if I scream.
He felt embarrassed. He felt confused.
Screaming, crying.
Wait, why?
Well, it turns out that was the first time that he had ever heard his voice the way that you and I hear his voice. And
wait,
so,
first time. What does that even mean?
He never heard a recording of himself, or?
Well, no. He had not only had he never heard a recording of himself, but when he talks,
I hear myself like I hear you.
What do you mean by that?
Like, I mean...
He tells me that he actually didn't know that his voice was slow. He hears me talk normal, And then he hears himself talk normal as well. Like,
he think he's slow and speeding up, or do you think he just thinks he's regular?
It's not like he speeds both of us
up. Does he mean like your voice just, or his voice just feels normal, or does he mean it actually sounds normal?
It sounds exactly the same, is what I'm saying. Like, he thinks could be sitting here right now, he would hear you talk, you'd hear me talk, and then he would say something, and in his head, it's all the same speed.
But that doesn't make sense, because it's like variable speed. You know?
I don't think he's, no, I think he thinks he's just normal. I'm normal inside.
So we went back and forth and back and forth on this until finally.
I mean, we need a specialist at this point.
Guess we'll all take our positions. Ready?
We ended up calling this guy who we've had on the show before.
All right, so Andy Oren's here.
Oren Davinsky, neurologist, NYU Medical Center.
He's the doctor.
Hi, Andy.
Hi, Oren.
Anyhow, Andy ran him through the whole story.
Yeah, well, he was 8 years old, and he was, I believe
everything you've just heard. And here was Oren's reaction.
It's a fascinating case, and my first clinical question would be, did he know he moved slowly, but
absolutely,
not,
yeah.
But it was only for his own voice that he was unaware that he was different than everybody else.
Right.
So he does have feedback on himself. The one area he's not getting feedback on is his voice production, which interestingly happens in post-encephalitic Parkinson's patients. They're slow in all their movements. They're slow getting up out of a chair. They're slow walking. But as with Kahn, there are some cases where they just get little focal areas that they don't see their slowness. So Oliver Sacks, when he took care of his awakenings patients at Beth Abraham Hospital in the Bronx, would sometimes record their voices and play it back, and they'd say, "That's not me. You're fiddling with a tape machine. Huh. That's not my voice."
Because really? The voice to them would sound
too slow.
Too slow.
Too slow.
Yeah, that's exactly, Kahn.
Do you think his inner voice, his inner mental speed, is truly as fast, or is that also slow?
Oh, it's absolutely normal.
Okay.
There was never a point where I was having to, like, wait for Kahn to make some, you know, mental exercise before he'd respond.
What I don't understand fully is why he hears you, Andy, speaking at three times his pace and feel you're normal. But something about his own voice feeding back to his own brain, he never perceived that at a different speed than your voice and everyone else's.
Do you trust it?
Yeah,
do you wonder about
would you suspect that if you met him, you'd learn something different than you?
Yeah, no, in medicine, you should always trust the patient's report, but keep in the back of your head a drop of skepticism. Yeah. But my gut as a clinician is more than 95%. It's real.
Now, keep in mind, that was not a true clinical diagnosis. That was just Oren Davinsky giving us his gut opinion.
Well, I have a theory. Okay. I have a theory. Unscientific, though it may be.
Well, that's what we specialize in.
Right. Welcome to the club.
I think that it has something to do with familiarity. Like, when I first met Kahn and I heard his voice, it was so foreign and so strange, and I could hardly make out what he was saying. But now, I'm surprised when people say, "What did he just say?" And I think, "Well, he just said he was horrified." You know, I've grown so familiar to his voice that it
is. It sort of like going into a Shakespeare play and an act one, scene two, you don't know what's going on, but somehow in the second act it begins to click.
Exactly, it's that familiarity, and if I have it, I mean, imagine what he must have.
Yeah, I've grown accustomed to hearing something different.
But what I don't get is, like, this went on for years. So how come no one told him?
His parents and his siblings and his friends have never turned to him and said, "Hey, what? You know, come on, speed it up." They've never ever said that.
Well, no. His parents being deaf, you know, cross them out. They couldn't have told him.
His parents are deaf.
Both of them. And Kahn thinks that everyone else just assumed that he knew what his own voice sounded like.
Really? Like, when you talk to his friends.
Hello.
Hey, Haley.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey, Dave. What's up?
Oh, not much. What's up, Andy?
I mean, and you told them the whole thing.
To the point.
What was their reaction?
Honestly, most of them didn't believe me.
You're kidding.
Did you know this at all?
No, I had no idea. I didn't know that. And so when he speaks, he just thinks that it sounds just like anyone else?
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So after he found out about his voice, which I guess was the one thing he thought was normal, what did he do?
Well,
he said,
"I'm never gonna talk again."
Did he talk again? Obviously he did, right?
Well, that's the same question I asked him.
After you heard that you were different,
how long did you go before talking again? And he told me...
I do remember going back to school.
And he doesn't recall, like, the first conversation exactly that he had, but he thinks it went something like...
Shut up and leave me the hell alone.
He didn't want to talk, but gradually he realized that he kind of had to.
And what about singing? You said he liked to sing.
Well, eventually he got comfortable again with the idea of having his voice recorded, his singing voice recorded, and so... After the interview was over, he mentioned the song that he actually had been singing a lot, and so I turned the recorder back on and asked if he would sing it for me.
So, tell me the name of the song, and then just sing away.
This is Grey Room by Damien Rice. Well, I've been here before, sat on the floor in a gray, gray room.
It was actually pretty emotional for us both. And as I'm sitting there hearing him sing this song, I'm just wondering, like, what does this sound like in his head? So after I got the tape recorded, I brought it back to my friends in Chicago in a band called Hudson Branch, and all of them know Con. And I asked them, like, do you think that we could maybe play some music to this? So the music could kind of give us a peek into the way that Con hears it and the way that Con feels it, and maybe we could feel it too.
Stuck by the phone again. Well, I've been here before. Sat on the floor in a gray, gray room. Gray, gray room. Never gonna talk again. As a good thing, I always thought of myself as I heard myself as a good singer.
What did Khan say when he heard it, by the way? Did it remind him of anything, like what he feels?
Yeah, I mean, when he heard it, he said, hell f- yes. It was a quote from him, but yeah. No, he loves it. He loves it.
Thanks to producer Andy Mills, who just received an award at the Third Coast Festival for a shorter version of that piece. And thanks also to Con Ashmore.
And the band.
Yeah.
And they call themselves Hudson Branch.
You can find out more about them at radiolab.org. And they have a new album out, just out, called World Kid.
And we will be right back.
This is Mike from El Dorado Hills, California. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And this hour,
4 stories of when brains attack. Times when you and your brain have a falling out, so to speak.
And our final story, it's really a doozy. It comes from reporter Mark Phillips.
Yes.
Okay, so Mark, what are we hearing?
Well, I went to visit this incredible woman named Diane Van Deren.
Hey.
You found us. Come on in, man.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
She lives just south of Denver in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains.
Oh, it's a cool view of makes Denver look tiny.
Doesn't it?
So who is she? Why is she a person of note?
Well, she's one of the best ultra runners in the world.
What's an ultra runner?
The definition is just anything longer than a marathon. The majority of them that she runs are 100 miles.
100? This is continuous miles?
Continuous.
No sleep, 28 hours straight.
Wow.
You know, I can tell you what pain is. I can tell you what pain is. And I was fortunate. I got runner-up to Lance Armstrong for Outdoor Person of the Year years ago. And I kind of think Lance and I have stories that are very parallel.
How so?
Well, it's interesting. She was always an athlete. She actually played professional tennis for a while. She came to running later in life. And oddly enough, her running career started with a seizure.
My first seizure, gosh, I do remember it.
It was 1988. Diane was 28 years old.
I had 2 children, married. I was 3 weeks into my 3rd pregnancy.
And one day,
I was with my mom. We were in the car. And as we were driving around, I remember reaching for like the glove compartment box. And I remember as I was reaching for that, I had this funny sensation. It was quick and it was brief. And then, boom, that's the last thing I remember.
And next thing she knows, she's waking up in the hospital.
I was confused. I didn't know where I was, what I was doing, what happened. And eventually, I ended up getting with a doctor, Dr. Spitz.
And after some tests,
they sent me off for an MRI.
He told her,
what you have is epilepsy. That was the first time I heard that word.
The seizure was just out of the blue?
Well, what the doctors eventually figured out is that when she was a baby, she had a fever.
And I ended up throwing a grand mal seizure, which lasted almost an hour.
That's the big one, yeah. And they kind of put together that she probably damaged a part of her brain from that seizure.
And then 24 years later, basically, boom, seizures reoccurred.
And you said earlier that this somehow led to her running?
Yeah, okay. So after the seizure, the first seizure in the car, mm-hmm. they started to happen more and more. But before the seizures would come on, she would have this warning sign.
I would get really tingly all over my body. I'd feel kind of floaty, the premonition that something's about to happen.
She was in the shower, she would have to get out.
Okay, where do I need to be? What do I need to do? And then it would happen. I tried every medication that was available. Diets, nutrition. I mean, I tried it all.
Basically, nothing was working.
Nothing worked.
Until
I found the only way I could break the cycle of a seizure for me. Whenever I had that premonition a seizure was coming on, I'd have my running shoes by the front door.
She'd be eating dinner. She would feel a premonition, just drop her fork and knife.
Throw those running shoes on. And I just showed you these mountains here by my house. I'd run to the Pikes National Forest.
Yeah, let's just run in silence for a second.
Okay.
So we can get some sound of that.
Yeah.
Her house is literally, you know, on the foothills of these mountains.
Sometimes we can see a herd of elk out here. I've seen a mountain lion out here. A lot of deer. Whenever I had a seizure coming on, I'd go run. Well, of course, my family, my mom, everybody was panicking because they were thinking, oh my gosh, Diane's going to be off running in the middle of nowhere, have a seizure, and we're not going to know where she is, how to find her, what we're going to do.
But
I found that that it worked.
She wasn't having seizures.
So when she would run, she'd have a premonition, but no actual seizure at the end?
Yeah.
When I ran from the seizures and I'd run to the forest, I would just feel me just getting more relaxed. My heart wouldn't be pounding. Calmness set in. And that is where my love for running began.
Literally outrunning the seizures. And at first it'd just be an hour or so, but then she was going for longer and longer. 2 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours. And it sort of worked for a while. But eventually,
the seizures basically just started overcoming.
They caught up with her.
I was having 3 to 5 seizures a week. I wasn't getting those premonitions like I did in the beginning.
It got to the point where she didn't have enough time to get her running shoes on.
I didn't have that long of a premonition. It was like, boom, seizure. So I could tell that part of my brain was actually getting weaker. And I knew at that point in time, I really was at more of a risk of dying from a seizure.
You could die from a seizure?
Happens all the time. People die of seizures all the time. For example, a friend of mine, his wife, she went up to go take a bath, had a seizure, went up later, and he found her dead in the tub. You know, my kids, I always had to tell them, hey, mom's taking a bath, come check on me. I, as a parent, as a wife, as a mom of 3 small children, I was running out of options.
And, you know, she talked with her doctors, and they said, well, there's a chance you could have a surgery that would fix this. If the seizures are coming from just one discrete part of the brain, they can cut that part of the brain out. But first, they have to figure out if it's that type of seizure and where it's coming from.
To see if it was operable.
Which meant she had to go to the hospital and actually have a seizure in front of them.
I had to have 64 electrodes basically glued onto my scalp.
She was hooked up to an EEG machine. And
I had a camera on me 24/7. And
there's footage of this. She showed it to me.
I remember laying there in the bed saying, I can't run. I need to let it happen.
What you see on the screen is she starts to jerk. She's clenched. She's shaking. You hear the bed sort of rattling. And she bites her tongue so hard that, you know, there's just this pool of blood below her face. She's choking on her blood. It's horrifying.
And then as I came out of it, honest to God, I felt like I'd been run over by a truck. I was gurgling, still in some blood that was in my throat, and I had a massive headache. But
the doctors are standing right next to her, cheering.
All right, we got it.
Because they actually found that the seizures were coming from one spot in the brain.
Then when they said, well, what do you think? We found the spot. You could be a surgery candidate.
I mean, it's a big risk. It's not like just taking a pill. I mean, you're cutting out a chunk of your brain.
Was it a tough decision, or was it just sort of a no-brainer? No pun intended.
Let's see here. Well, in all honesty, it was hands down. I was like, let's go. So they saw the side of my right head open. I just literally just sawed it open. And so there was my brain exposed while I was on the table.
So the doctors huddle around and they look in and they can actually see this gray, discolored spot from all the seizure activity. It's on the back right side. It's a part of the brain called the temporal lobe, which is the part of the brain that seems to be involved in memory, spatial reasoning, and temporal reasoning, time.
And they had to, you know, decide, okay, well, how much of her brain are we going to take out? And they go back and forth. I mean, obviously, the more brain that they take out, the more consequence, the more side effects. Well, they ended up cutting out probably the size of a kiwi out of my right temporal lobe.
That's big.
Yeah, it's not insignificant.
Wow.
When I came home, I just had horrific headaches. I mean, this extreme pain. I mean, I just remember just holding my head, just trying to hold my head together. It just hurt so bad that and seizure-wise, they didn't know. So everybody was kind of on pins and needles. Did it work? Did it not work?
And as the days went on, they waited and waited and waited.
And I wasn't having seizures.
None at all?
No. She's not had a seizure since the night before the surgery. So you didn't really get into the competitive ultra running until after the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about? I mean,
how did I get into this? It was interesting. I did a 50-mile race. I won that.
Wait,
I thought, okay.
What?
Here's where things kind of get interesting. After a year or so of no seizures, Diane decided to enter this race, a 50-miler on a whim.
I just read about it in a magazine. You know, I love to run, and I thought, oh, man, I have this new outlook on life. I don't have seizures. Okay, I'm going to run a 50. I won that, and then I signed up for my first 100-mile race. Of course, everybody was like, oh, my gosh, a race in the Bighorn Mountains of all places. Did well. I ended up placing.
At the same time, back home.
When did you start to notice, that things were different, working differently in your brain?
I didn't. My family started noticing things. Mom's forgetting, what time my appointments were. We're late to school. Mom's not here to pick me up.
So she was having short-term memory loss.
Yeah, a lot.
Meeting somebody in the morning, later on that afternoon, maybe I see them again and I have no idea who they were. They'll have to say, hey, remember I saw you? Those kind of things. But let's see, what was I saying?
Meanwhile, first overall in the Alfred Packer 50-miler, second overall in the Bear 100-miler, first overall in the Tahoe Rim 100-miler. I could keep going.
Yeah, go.
First overall in the 24 Hours in Frisco Trial Run, first for women's in the Dances with the Dirt 50-miler in Hell, Michigan.
Dances with the Dirt in Hell, Michigan.
First in women's in the Canadian Death Race 78-miler in Edmonton, Canada.
The Canadian Death Race?
Yeah.
The Yukon Arctic Ultra 300-miler was minus 48 degrees when we began the event. The shoes literally froze on my feet, and only two of us finished. I ran the first 100 miles with no water. Did 430 miles in the Yukon pulling a sled.
During which time she'd sleep only about an hour a night.
For 10 days.
Wow.
Really?
The crazy thing is that through all of this, she can't read a map.
What? What do you mean?
Well, one of the main functions of that kiwi-sized part of her brain that the doctors took out, as I said, was spatial reasoning. And so after the surgery, maps just look weird to her.
It's like just a bunch of information on a piece of paper. All those lines, all those squigglies.
Just noise.
So then how does she navigate through a race?
Well, I take a pink ribbon with me. So when I'm out there in the middle of nowhere and I have three ways to hit a trail and I'm not quite sure which way to go.
Is it left? Is it right?
I'll pick a way. I'll drop a ribbon.
And then after a couple hours, if she feels like she's not on a trail anymore, she just goes back until she gets to the pink ribbon and then she picks the other way.
On the Yukon, there was a time where, I was lost for 2 hours. Wow. I was out in the middle of nowhere all alone, huge heavy winds, just ripping across the Yukon River.
Did you win that year that you were lost for 2 hours?
Yeah.
Mostly, Diane finds these sort of workarounds for what she lost in the surgery. But the fact is, she only became this amazing runner after the surgery. So while we were talking, I just couldn't help but wonder.
Well, I mean, I wonder, like, do you think...
Did having part of your brain removed make you an ultra runner?
And do you understand the question?
I do.
And she says no.
I think having a brain injury puts me at a disadvantage. But I think for me, the one advantage, if I had to say I have an advantage, would be time. I can really get lost in time.
When the doctors removed that part of her brain, they took out a basic awareness of time passing.
Time's hard. So when I'm on the Yukon, I'm going for 10 days. I kind of forget how many days I've been out there. You know, some of the racers are saying, oh, I've been out here 6 days, I'm exhausted. For me,
I can't look back. I can't think, how long I've been running because I don't know.
I stay in the moment.
because of that, she doesn't know how tired she should feel.
Huh. Think about it. If you don't know where you are in time,
you don't know how much further you have to go, how far you've been. You're just running. You're just hearing your footsteps, and that's it.
I get a rhythm in my mind. That's what I want to hear in my feet. I go by rhythm. I know the sound that my feet, about what an 8-minute pace would be, how my feet would sound.
So count off the beat for me.
10, 3, 4, 1, 10, 3, 4, 1, 10. You're a drummer. You hear it?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. And even with my breath, in 2, out 2. 2 breaths in, 2 breaths out. Match my feet. See the rhythm?
Yeah.
If that's all I have to hear for 28 hours, that's what I want. That's music. That's my music. It's nothing else in my mind but my feet and my rhythm, my breathing. That's the music to an athlete's ear. That's the flow.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, no problem.
Reporter Mark Phillips. For more information on Diane Van Deren, you can go to our website, radiolab.org. We've got some links there. And I guess that's it. I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Diane.
Hey, guys. It's Mark Phillips.
Here we go. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad.
Jad Abumrad. Our staff includes Ellen Horn,
Doran Wheeler, Pat Walters,
Jim Howard, Brenna Farrell,
Melissa O'Donnell,
Dylan Casey, Kiffy,
Dylan Keefe,
Lynn Levy, and Sean Cole.
With help from Douglas Q. Smith, Daisy Rosario,
Nadia Wilson, Brendan McMullen, and Rafaela Benin, B-E-N-N-I-N, Benin? Yeah.
That's it. Okay.
that's the credits. All right, Radiolab. Talk to you later. Bye.
End of message.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.